This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.
Welcome to Taiwan Bound. I'm Ido Aharoni, your host, and today it is my distinct pleasure to host Professor Chani Lerner.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Chani Lerner is the head of the School for Political Science, Government, and International Relations, and her office is in the legendary Naftali building, which I had the pleasure of attending in the early 1980s. It's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
You're a longstanding friend, and I don't know how you do this, but when I first met you 20 years ago, you still look exactly the same. Why, I am completely different today, lost my hair, and I'm overall declined, but it's good to see you.
You also look the same.
I know, I was fishing for a compliment. These are interesting days today, and your specialty, and as a political scientist, is of course the history of constitutions, and you are engaged in comparative research, comparing one culture from another, political science from another, and it's always fascinating to discuss, and especially now when we have this constitutional crisis in Israel. But before we talk about what's happening today, I'd like to begin the conversation with a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your background, and how did you end up becoming an expert on constitutions?
Well, thank you for the question. I'm a graduate of Tel Aviv University. Actually, I started studying, I graduated from the Faculty of Humanities. I have a BA in History and Philosophy and a Master's degree in Philosophy. But I became interested in sort of political philosophy and then moved to New York, got my PhD in political science, started actually from the political theory side of the discipline, and then kind of moved towards comparative politics. My PhD dissertation was on constitution making in deeply divided societies.
And that's when we met. It was right, almost 20 years ago, and this was during my first overseas, my first posting in New York as a diplomat, and right. You were getting your PhD at Columbia.
Right.
So which societies did you study in your PhD?
So I wanted to compare Israel to similar cases of countries that addressed or tried to write their constitution while in the context of deep disagreement between different factions in society over identity issues, over central sort of identity questions. Back then, it was in the early 20s, the field of constitution making was very much concentrated on the issues of democracy, institutions, and I remember taking a class with two leading professors, the leading researchers in the area of constitutions and constitution making. And they, most of their examples focused on either the US or Western Europe. And the main sort of idea or concept was that the moment of constitution making is the moment in which the people, you know, kind of decides over the basic rules of the democratic game. And then I remember I raised my hand and asked, but what happens if the people do not agree, if societies are divided over serious, you know, issues such as religion and state or ethnic or national identity? And these famous professors said, oh, no, constitutions, it's not about identity. We didn't think about these issues. And then I realized, okay, someone needs to write the book, and that was
the
project.
So when you say identity, if you can further explain what you mean by that, because I'm not sure all of our listeners will understand that.
So I some countries are it's actually a debatable question among researchers, but one could look at the different countries around the world and divide them into two separate groups. One is countries where there's more or less kind of researchers called overlapping consensus, more or less sort of basic understanding about the basic values and norms that should underpin state policies. And then there are countries that are divided between different identity groups where it's difficult to move or transfer between these groups. So, for example, countries that are divided between different religious groups, between different ethnic groups, between different linguistic groups.
India, for example.
Exactly. So the cases that I studied were India. Later on, after finishing my initial sort of dissertation project, I moved on to other countries such as Turkey, Indonesia, Sri Lanka. The first book compared Israel, India, and Ireland. So Ireland wrote their first constitution in 1922, right after the Civil War. So Ireland was also a divided country back then. Much more extreme and sort of bloody conflicts rather than, you know,
right,
ideological or political conflicts that we are familiar with in the Western world.
Yeah. So for the benefit of our listeners that don't know what's happening today in Israel, but we are in the midst of a fierce battle over the future of the Israeli system and what the government is referring to a legitimate reform. Structural reform is being viewed by, I would say, a solid majority of Israelis, including people that voted for this coalition, as an illegitimate attempt to try and change Israel's DNA. And that highlights the fact that Israel has no constitution and Israel has no separation between religion and state. And the question is to you, Professor Lerner, why is that? Why Israel doesn't have a constitution? Why did we separate church and state like the Americans did earlier in history?
So again, like any, you know, complicated sort of development or political development, there are many reasons, and historians and political kind of theorists argue over why Israel doesn't have a constitution. The fact is that in 1948, when Israel was founded, the part of the Declaration of Independence included actually a statement about the future constitution. The first elections for the Israeli legislature was actually, in fact, for a constituent assembly. The first election in 1949 was for a constituent assembly, but then on its second meeting, the constituent assembly decided to transform itself into a legislature. Israel is not the only country where it happened. India, the same thing happened. The legislature or the parliament holds both legislative powers to make ordinary laws and a constituent power to make a constitution. In a year and a half later, the Knesset decided not to draft a complete constitutional document. Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, was the main objector to this idea of drafting a constitution. Actually, Menachem Begin, the head of the Chirut party, was the kind of a fierce supporter of the idea of drafting a constitution, including a comprehensive Bill of Rights. Why Ben-Gurion objected the idea of the constitution? There are many reasons. In a famous speech that he gave, in a very long speech that he gave in the Knesset explaining his position, he said that Israel doesn't need a constitution because the institutions of the state exist. Israel doesn't have the need to create this kind of contract between a federal government and states as in the U.S. So Israel is different in the sense that there is no institutional need, in his view, for a written constitution. He also didn't want to limit the executive. He thought that it would be a waste of time to argue about values and about, you know, principles when their most urgent need at that time was to bring Jewish immigrants into the country, to build the country, and to focus on sort of putting facts on the ground in terms of creating the Jewish state. He said in a statement, if there are going to be when there are 2 million Jews in Israel, that would be our constitution. There were also additional arguments during the early debates in the Knesset. Those debates in the Knesset, some argue that it would be a more democratic process if the constitution will be written after the waves of immigrants will arrive into the country. At that time, 1948, most of the sort of future citizens of the country were outside of Israel. So the idea was to bring them in and then argue and debate and draft a constitution that, you know, sort of fits or represents the norms of the
Well, people. You know, and, I'm sorry.
Just one last issue is the debate over the place of religion and what does it mean to have a Jewish state. I think that the leadership at that time did not want to sort of entrench a secular or too secular or too religious sort of principles into the constitution in order to not prevent the immigration of Jewish sort of diaspora from all over the world. They didn't want to, you know, kind of create some kind of opposition from the secular side or from the religious side. So this, so left things sort of open. And also they believed that in the future it would be easier to agree on these kind of liberal principles, secular principles.
So the idea was to introduce later on a set of what we call basic laws that one day will amount into a constitution that was... So Ben-Gurion was... a rare combination of a strategist and a tactician. And usually he was a brilliant strategist, but I think that here I think he misread the, and maybe, you tell me what you think, maybe the fact that, and again, I'm not an expert on the psychology of leadership, but maybe that generation of Jewish leaders that all came from very orthodox family, yet did not observe Jewish orthodox religious practice. Although I must say that at least on the socialist part, and maybe also on the revisionist part, but mostly on the socialist part, they were deploying the same religious fervor of orthodox people, like Ade Gordon with the religion of labor. And Ben-Gurion also had this fervor that is characteristic of very religious people, although his religion was different. Question is, if they had a soft spot in their heart for Jewish orthodoxy, and that's the reason why they did not want to confront them back in the day?
I don't know if it was a soft spot or maybe it was a strategic move. There was no question about the Jewish identity of the state, so there was no need to sort of entrench it in a formal document. I think also Ben-Gurion was kind of, you know, part of, I mean, his generation of leaders, post-World War II kind of leaders of the new countries that were founded in Asia and such as Israel or India or in North Africa, such as Algeria. These countries were founded by leaders who were secular, socialist, and had a vision about the future of their country. They did not imagine the rise of religious sort of politics, you know, in the decades that followed the independence in their countries. Back then, in the sort of late 40s, early 50s, the idea of modernism was the main kind of consensus. The, you know, Nehru in India and other leaders in the region were founded their countries on the basis of secular, socialist, liberal ideas. They did not think that these will be so divisive and so conflicted, you know, 50 years later.
And that was part of the moment of global optimism following the end of the war and the establishment of the United Nations. And in fact, Israel's proclamation of independence is making reference to the United Nations Charter, which is very unusual. Today, it would never happen, of course. And then maybe that explains the affinity or the connection that Ben-Gurion felt to Turkey's Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And so what have you learned about Turkey? I'm very fascinated about that case.
So Turkey, as opposed to Israel, did not establish a democratic system. So the main difference between, you know, countries like Israel and India is that despite the divisions that are kind of characterized as societies, they did manage to create democratic institutions. In India, in Turkey, the political system was never fully democratic. The first constitution, Atatürk's revolution and first constitution was written in 1924. The first sort of 10 years were characterized by a very, very kind of top-down revolution of a very harsh process of secularization. He was influenced actually by the Bolshevik kind of revolution, tried to promote development and push forward the sort of economy of the country, but not through democratic or liberal means, as opposed to India, for example. Then only in 1945, Turkey became adopted sort of a multi-party system and had their first elections. And since then, twice already in the early 60s and in the early 1982, when parties that were perceived by the sort of elite, secular military elite as too religious, those parties were either removed from government and the military took over and drafted a new constitution. So the current constitution was actually drafted in 1982, but under sort of the control of the military. In recent years, Erdogan, in the 90s, there was a hope that Turkey will become more democratic. But then when Erdogan sort of took over, there was another hope. Actually, in around 2007, there was a very important committee chaired by Özbudun, someone I had close connections with. They did draft a constitution, a new constitution, but it was not adopted. And then in 2016, the sort of attempted coup was the excuse for Erdogan to completely sort of change the regime in Turkey. And according to sort of comparative measurements, Turkey is not longer even considered sort of sort of semi-authoritarian. It is a complete authoritarian system now.
So it's not even a crippled democracy.
No.
Now, let me ask you a question that really bothers a lot of people, and that's about the perceived weakness of the Knesset. So you said the Knesset has two powers. One power is to draft laws and pass them, the legislative power, and then the power to draft the constitution. Now, many people claim that the Knesset has never been weaker for all sorts of reasons. What do you think needs to happen in order for the Knesset to exercise, and successfully, its authority to draft a constitution?
To begin with, what is needed is a political will of the members of the Knesset. You're right that in terms of the sort of institutional relationship between the Knesset, the Israeli legislature, and the government, the executive, the Israeli parliament is especially weak institution compared to the government, and became even weaker in recent years because of different sort of changes in the regulations. So any coalition, any 61 members of the Knesset that form a coalition control any decision that is made by the legislature. So there's very little ability for the Israeli Knesset to supervise and oppose.
By the way, an interim question. What can be done to change that? Because we know, for example, the American system, that the country is divided into districts, and therefore legislators are indebted to their constituents, and that changes everything. What can be done in Israel to change that, what you just described?
Yeah. So That's a very big question. Obviously, I think we do need to think about our political system and maybe either change electoral rules. Going back, by the way, to Ben-Gurion, one other reason that he objected the drafting of the constitution was he wanted to change the electoral system in Israel and turn it into regional sort of districts. He thought that the current sort of electoral system that is based on party system with one district, the entire country is one electoral district, is not a good idea. He very much liked the British system that also doesn't have a written constitution, but has kind of a, you know, informal kind of collection of constitutional principles. What needs to be done, it would be an ideal if a constituent assembly would have been elected and rethink, you know, our political system and draft the constitution. Whether it's a realistic project, I'm not sure.
Let me ask you, what are the processes that brought us to this point, socially and politically? We are facing the worst constitutional crisis in Israel's history, and we don't even have a constitution. So, I mean, it's really crazy what's happening, right? Israel's democracy is being challenged from within. Question is, this not happened overnight, right? It's a result of a long process that took place over decades. What would you say are the main factors that brought us here?
So one main factor is the lack of a complete constitution. I think that Israel does have a constitution, it's just not complete. So we do have a series of 13 basic laws that were enacted over the years. The process was just never completed. There are two missing sort of elements. And I think if they were put in place, maybe the situation would have been much easier to sort of, you know, maneuver. One is the basic law and legislation that is missing and that is being debated in the past several years. The previous government formed a committee chaired by Gideon Saar, and they tried to draft the basic law on legislation. This sort of missing link is supposed to define the balance of power between the legislature and the judiciary, which is exactly kind of the core of the conflict, the current conflict. There's also no agreement, or there's no sort of formal decision on what is the proper process for enacting basic laws. So the Harari decision from 1950 that we talked about earlier left sort of this issue, the procedural issue, kind of open. The decision of the Knesset in 1950 was that the Knesset will enact basic laws in a gradual manner over the years, and eventually, at some point in the future, they will all be gathered together into one constitutional document. But there is no decision on what should be the content of the constitution, how basic laws should be drafted, whether with special majority, a regular majority, and procedure for amending basic laws. So this is a basic kind of institutional problem. I think the other missing element in our incomplete constitution is the lack of the principle of equality. Israel is the only democracy in the world that does not have a formal entrenchment of the principle of equality in basic law or in legislation in general. We do have the basic law on human dignity and liberty, which is interpreted by the court as sort of applying a non-discriminatory kind of idea. But
the issue of equality is mentioned in the Proclamation of Independence. What is the relationship between the Proclamation of Independence and all the legislative aspects that you study?
Yeah. So the Proclamation of Independence has a very important symbolic role. Defines the values and norms of the state. It is also often cited in Supreme Court decisions, and it kind of inspires and influences informally legislation and Supreme Court and court decisions, but it does not have a formal obligatory kind of role. So it's not a law.
And is it, would it be possible? Are there any historical precedents of countries that were able to form or draft a constitution, agree on a constitution after such a rift in society and politics?
It's a question I get a lot in recent days. There are many cases of democratic countries that tried to draft their constitution, that succeeded draft their constitution. Some processes fail because of various reasons. Just recently in Chile, they tried to draft a constitution. They actually created a very interesting process that involved a lot of civil society organizations and kind of independent groups. But eventually the draft failed in the referendum. And now they've initiated another kind of procedure. There are only three countries in the world that do not have a written constitution. Israel is one of them. All of them are democratic countries. The UK and New Zealand are the other two. Countries do write and change and amend their constitution.
But in their cases, I'm not familiar with the system in New Zealand, but I'm somewhat familiar with the system in the UK, and I know that there are other checks and balances which we don't have. And you specifically mentioned the weakness of the Israeli Knesset, the legislature, which is a big deficiency in the design of the Israeli political system. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of the many of the people that are listening to us don't really know the differences between the Israeli political system and, let's say, the American or the Canadian or the British political system. What would you say are the main, for example, a lot of people think that Netanyahu was elected personally, that we elect individuals. So what would you say to our listeners are the big elements for them to know about the Israeli political system that makes it unique?
I think, well, such a comparison, I think, might be difficult to pinpoint, specific issues, because any country is somewhat unique in its own way. So, from a comparative sort of perspective as a political scientist, many argue that the U.S. actually is the unique country, has a very unique political system that sort of emerged because of its own political background and political sort of consequences. Also, the UK has a very unique history. So I think every country had developed its own unique kind of institutions that are kind of embedded in their history and the political concerns and political issues that the founding generation or the political leaders at some crisis moment or some important other kind of critical junctures were concerned with. So it's hard to kind of, I think, identify uniqueness, because all countries have some shared institutions, but also unique in their own way. There's no copy-paste in constitution making for that reason.
Right, right. But I think that when you look at the Israeli system and you compare it to other Western systems, I think what makes the Israeli system so unique is the fact that we have a party system. It's a parliamentarian coalition. The coalition is a process between parties and not between individuals.
That's true.
Yet the perception is that the individuals are actually being elected. And that, I think, creates a confusion in the world. People really don't understand the Israeli political system because of it. And I get a lot of questions about that.
Yeah. That's part of the sort of privatization of politics that I think happened in Israel in recent years. And again, here, Israel, I don't think is totally unique. It's part of the kind of a trend. the rise of populist leaders and the idea of sort of personalization of politics that was to some extent influenced by the American kind of political culture.
Well, we Professor Lerner, we're running out of time. I just wanted to ask you one last question, which I think is of interest to our audience. What are the chances that out of this mess, something good will emerge? Maybe an agreement on the contour lines of the Israeli political discourse, maybe even a constitution, maybe even, what are the chances something good will come out of it?
I think already something good is coming out of it. I actually am a little bit optimistic about the kind of, you know, cautious optimistic. I think as a, again, as a political scientist, as a someone who teaches for the past, I'm at Tel Aviv University, I mean, I'm teaching here since 2007, so 15 years. For the first time, I feel that there's some kind of a civics class across the country. The number of invitations and for lectures that I get, I give lectures in high-tech companies, in schools, in youth movements. There's a great interest in the public in you know, issues that we are dealing with and teaching in our classes. What is democracy? What is the difference between basic laws and ordinary laws? Suddenly, I think there's growing awareness for these political, very important issues. And I think we're going through some kind of transformation and education process of the Israeli public, which turns passive citizens into active citizens. And I think this is a very healthy and important process for sort of the vitality of democracy in Israel.
Wow. So what you're saying is actually pretty dramatic. What you're saying is that we're looking at the ascendance of a new political camp, the pro-democracy camp. And it may not be a party, but certainly a political mindset.
Yeah, and I think also so far, no damage has been made. I mean, so far, what we are witnessing is a very active and very vital democratic society. I mean, the demonstration, the protest, the public awareness for these issues, I think these are very good signs for healthy kind of democratic culture and the responsibility that citizens take for the regimes of their country. This is something that I've been teaching all these years, that democracy is something that needs to be protected by the citizens themselves.
And it's happening in front of our eyes.
And it is happening, yes.
Incredible. Well, Professor Lerner, thank you so much, first for educating us and second for inspiring us.
Thank you very much.
It was a real pleasure. And to our viewers and listeners, until the next episode, goodbye from Tel Aviv.
This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.